I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We're back for another of our intermittent weekly podcasts. I know that's a contradiction in terms, but life is busy and podcasting is not one of our priorities, honestly. It's the webzine and book publishing. Well, I'd like to begin by thanking our donors. We have just celebrated our 8th birthday on Monday of this week, the 11th. It's the 8th anniversary of Countercurrents going online. There's an article about that. Happy birthday to us. And every year we launch our annual fundraiser, which we run from June 11th through Halloween, the 31st of October. This year we're trying to raise $70,000. We're trying to make up for lost ground in year 8. Because in year 8, we suffered a major setback when we were deplatformed by PayPal after the Unite the Right rally. And what happened is our enemies used the moral hysteria connected with that, basically to get a lot of websites that had nothing to do with Unite the Right, or which were actually skeptical about the whole thing, like Countercurrents was. We got swept up in the hysteria, and we lost PayPal, we lost our web hosting platform, and it was very expensive, and we have not yet recovered in terms of our monthly donations, because a lot of people are so wedded to PayPal that they just haven't come back. So we have done really well in the first week, though, and we also received just recently several boxes of mail. It was forwarded from the P.O. box in San Francisco. So in terms of the contents of those boxes and the recent donations, we've got a lot of thank yous to give out. So let me just run through the list. I want to thank Hunter for $100, Randy for $20, Henry for $500, Joseph for $25, Ken for $100, Kevin for $20, John for $500, Brian for $50, Philip for $65, Carl for $25, Roger for $23, Richard for $50, James for $125, a fellow, I can't make out the name actually, but it starts with G-E-N for $50, Nelson for $25, Christian for $400, Rick for $100, Gene for $200, Randy again, the same Randy for $20, James for $20, and we also had a birthday dinner for Countercurrents last Friday. And there was a bit of a fundraiser connected with that. And after we paid all the expenses, there were $283 left over for Countercurrents. So those donations add up to $2,701, which is very, very generous. And we thank you. It's a very good start for our annual fundraiser.
Thanks a lot, everybody. It's really appreciated that you help to keep our lights on and keep our noses to the grindstone with this thing.
We also received some books and CDs, and I just want to mention a few of those. We received a copy of the Racial Loyalist Manifesto by Matt Hale. I appreciate that. We received a copy of Joao Franco, I hope I pronounced that correctly, The Tragedy of Globalization in Portuguese. Roger sent us copies of 1985 and also Brave New World Revisited. We received a book by someone named Wolf Hetze called The Sunset of Tradition and the Origin of the Great War, which looks very interesting. And we received some CDs from an artist or a pair of artists called Lilu and John. I guess this is review copies, so I'm going to have to pop those in and give them a spin. And anyway, I very much appreciate those gifts as well. So thank you so much, everyone, again, for your help to Countercurrents. So, John, I understand that you have been doing some traveling, and I've been doing some traveling, too.
Yeah, I actually just got back from a trip to Iceland, where I'd never been before. Some friends of mine invited me, and it was quite a good experience, actually. I wrote this on Facebook. I said that it's probably the most Germanic landscape I can imagine, not in the sense that it's like Germany, because it's almost nothing like Germany, but in the sense it reflects to me what I think of as like the Germanic aesthetic or the Germanic consciousness, because it's a very primordial place, very stark. And also, of course, this time of year, since we're approaching the solstice, you've got the white nights happening. So, you know, it's daylight 24 hours a day, which gives the whole landscape a kind of luminous feel. And I was very lucky to be able to stay at an Airbnb out in the countryside. And it was really beautiful, I have to say. I mean, there was a horse farm nearby, Icelandic horses, which are a special breed of horse, which I was told by an Icelander while I was there that they're such a protected species that if an Icelandic horse is taken out of the country to go to a contest in some other country, that horse is never allowed back into Iceland. He or she becomes a permanent expat at that point, because they don't want to risk any contamination of the Icelandic species.
That's interesting. I guess they're worried about diseases.
Yeah, that too. I think that's the main thing. And they do, I mean, they look pretty similar to European horses, but they're slightly smaller, mm-hmm. was my impression. But other than that, there was nothing else around where we were staying, and it was quite gorgeous. And you can see off in the distance columns of steam rising from where geysers and thermal baths, natural thermal baths, exist. And you also, of course, see on the mountaintops are capped with ice, even at this time of year. So it's fire and ice.
Yeah.
As they say, with the Germanic paganism. You really see it in action there. And I really felt like, you know, this is Odin's place. When I was there, his spirit is still very much alive there, I would say.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, I've only changed planes at the Reykjavik airport. And I have to say that was not a primordial or inspiring landscape. It was just endless lines of people and incredibly overpriced food. I bought a salad, and when I was going through my credit card receipts, I discovered that I paid $30 for a salad in the Reykjavik airport.
That's not that much more than usual. I mean, one beer cost me between $15 and $20. In Icelandic kroner.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't, unless you have some money to burn, it's not a place you want to spend too much time. But, the Reykjavik itself was quite interesting, but it felt a lot more like Scandinavia to me. You know, I've spent some time in Sweden and Denmark before. Mm-hmm. Well, the Icelandic people, naturally, I mean, they're extremely Nordic looking, probably more so than almost anyone else I've seen, with the possible exception of the Danes. They're probably the most Nordic looking people I've seen so far. I haven't been to Norway yet, so I don't want to sound like they're out of the running. But the problem with that is that, along with that goes the negative aspects of Scandinavia, and it was somewhat alarming to see that the streets of Reykjavik were really, well, crawling would be an exaggeration, but there were a lot of immigrants on the streets.
Hmm. Are you sure they weren't just tourists?
I don't think they all were. I mean, some of them undoubtedly were, but, well, I also spent some time on the university campus, at the University of Iceland. And they, grade school students attend there as well as university students. And a lot of the young kids were non-white as well.
That's very alarming.
So, yeah, so it's, and I talked to some Icelanders about this when I was there, and they said, yeah, you know, that they kind of suffer from the same, problem that, Scandinavia does, and that, you know, they have a very rich country, and they think that this should be extended to everybody. You know, everybody who wants it should be able to come in. I had the impression, though, that they're not quite as self-loathing as the Scandinavians are. You know, nobody said anything to me about, you know, Iceland being guilty of crimes against humanity and therefore, you know, needs to be brought out of existence. It seemed more like just simply the fact that they want to be generous and welcoming to people. And right. I have to say that the Icelandic people I dealt with were all very friendly and very welcoming, more so than in Scandinavia, I have to say. Hmm. So, yeah, I had a good impression of the place overall, but they definitely need to put a damper on the immigration situation.
Well, that's really interesting. I spent the month of April traveling, and I first went to Sweden. I was only there for a short time because I've been to Sweden three other times and spent longer periods of time there. I just flew in to attend the Skanza Forum and give a talk. And the Skanza Forum meeting was the third of their meetings, the second time they've done it in Stockholm. And there were about 175 people there, so it was their largest to date. Jared Taylor spoke, I spoke, Millennial Bo spoke, the Golden One, Marcus Folin spoke. There was a music performance by a special secret guest and his musical accompanist. And I'm probably blanking out somebody else, and I apologize if I'm forgetting somebody who's on the program. But it went really, really well. Frode Midjord organized it and presided over it. And I was quite happy with it. We had a good number of people come from Norway, also a large number of Swedes. I don't know if anyone was there from Finland, but the very next day, Finland had its first meeting of the type. So we got up in the morning and trooped off to the airport and flew to Helsinki. And it was a, you know, very quick flight. I forget what airline we took. I think it was Norwegian or EasyJet. It was a very quick flight. We were picked up by people in Helsinki at the airport and driven off to do a conference that very evening. And the conference was at a big old restaurant building. And there were more than 200 people there, which was quite impressive. The country has about 5 million Finns in it, I believe. And so for their first ethno-nationalist conference to have more than 200 people there was quite impressive. Jared spoke, I spoke, Frode spoke, a Millennial Woe spoke, Ramsey Paul was there, and he spoke. And there were several Finnish speakers who spoke in Finnish for the most part. I met a number of people there. Timo Hanakainen is a publisher who's sort of the publisher of the Finnish equivalent of Countercurrents. And he's translated a couple of my pieces, and I published a couple of his pieces at Countercurrents. Ruben Kalup was there from Estonia, and he spoke. So it was a very, very good program, a long program, but it was well divided up, and it didn't really get tedious because the talks were fairly short. And I was truly impressed. It was my first time in Finland. I liked the Finns. They were very, very friendly. They organized the thing very, very well. You can really tell that there's a distinction, an ethnic distinction, a genetic distinction, as well as a linguistic distinction between, say, the Finns and the Swedes. They look a little different. And you could sort of tell the Swedish, ethnically Swedish Finns from the ethnically Finnish Finns, because there is a Swedish minority in Finland. Finland is officially a bilingual country. They have all their signs and documents in Swedish and Finnish. It was for a long time part of the Swedish Empire, and then it was taken by Russia. And also, it's effectively a trilingual country because everybody there is very educated in English. And I had no difficulty as an English speaker doing anything in Finland. And I spent a couple of days in Helsinki after the event. I found a little hostel near the central train station. Very clean, very nice, in an old 19th century apartment building with enormously high ceilings. It was really cool. And it was quite reasonably priced. And so I spent a lot of time with a friend first day, the Monday after the conference, walking around central Helsinki and just looking at architecture. And the reason we were just looking at architecture is because on Mondays, a lot of the buildings, the museums and things like that are closed. So it was a lovely day. It was, I think in the 30s, low 40s maybe, sunny. I have some good winter stuff, so I was bundled up, but we were walking a lot and I did not feel cold at all. There was ice in the harbor, and we walked around the harbors, looked at various churches and museums, and the modern architecture in Helsinki is quite pleasing, too. So there's a lot of really nice architecture from the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And then the later architecture from the interwar period becomes a little more modern. It's a kind of stark neoclassical, Nordic neoclassical style, I guess. The Parliament building is in this kind of quasi-Egyptian style, actually, which I thought was very cool. And then the modern architecture, the glass and steel stuff, it's quite pleasing too. So I had a very, very positive impression of Helsinki. It's one of the nicest European cities I've been to. Everything was immaculate. Everything looked really good. There was very little graffiti. In fact, I don't think I saw any graffiti. Whereas, you know, Germany's just blighted with it. It's just like a bad case of acne everywhere in Germany, the graffiti.
Well, especially in Berlin. Yeah. I don't know if it's everywhere in Germany, but...
Yeah, it's everywhere, especially if you take a train. You just see it everywhere. So I took a train from the Helsinki Central Station to the airport, and I didn't see any graffiti at all along the route. And again, the public transportation was just excellent. It really shows you what you can have in a relatively homogeneous high IQ society. And actually, my first taste of that, because, you know, the homogeneous high IQ society I was born into has sort of destroyed itself during my lifetime. The first taste I had of that feel was actually in 2004 when I was briefly in South Korea. And even the aesthetic of it seemed very Northern European in terms, it was snowy outside and the lots of very modern architecture and sort of pale hardwoods and granite and stuff like that. I thought, this must be like Copenhagen or Helsinki or something, only it was entirely South Korean. But yeah, so I was very, very positively impressed. They do have an immigration problem there. They do have refugees coming in. The cultural Marxist agenda is pushed very, very hard by the cultural and political establishment. But they don't have that many of these people yet.
So it's not as bad as Sweden yet?
No, nowhere near as bad as Sweden. And judging from the turnout and the quality of the people at the conference, even a small number of foreigners has alerted them. So they have a strong cultural immune system there still. They have a strong ethnocentrism, and it's waking up. And I hope that they will switch things around. We had lunch in central Helsinki after we arrived. I think it was at a Italian restaurant, actually. They did have reindeer on the menu, though, even in the Italian restaurant.
Oh, and they did in Iceland, too.
Yeah. You can get reindeer ragu with your with your pasta. So anyway, we were there, and suddenly there was a march of brown people through the street. This was on a Sunday, a little afternoon. And I looked around, and not just the people at our table, but other Finns in the restaurant were rolling their eyes at this when they realized what it was. And it was a march of Afghans. They have enough Afghans in Helsinki for a march. And the Afghans were marching in protest of Pakistan. And I just thought, well, this is lovely. They've imported all this diversity, including all these hatreds and international problems to their country. And who knows, maybe the following or the previous day, maybe there was a Pakistani march against the Afghans. So, yeah, it was a nice indication of how multiculturalism and immigration is really just borrowing troubles that never existed in that country before. They have their diversity. They have their Swedish minority. They have their Lapish peoples further to the north. And they've managed to accommodate and deal with that, and they don't really need any more cultural diversity, I think, in Finland. They really have enough, and it's a lovely country. It works really, really well, and I really wish them the best, and I'd like to go back there and spend a lot more time exploring. Oh, Roger Devlin spoke at both events. I apologize, Roger. I just remembered you were in Stockholm and you were in Helsinki too, and gave a very good talk in both places. So after that, I went off to Germany, and then I went off to Hungary for a while, and then I flew back to the United States, and I went to the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. And that was a very well-organized conference. There were couple hundred people there. I forget the exact number. And basically, we filled up this entire resort at Montgomery Bell State Park. We had the whole hotel to ourselves. And the state really pulled out all the stops in providing security for the event. They did not want any kind of Charlottesville-type violence, basically. And so they kept the leftist demonstrators penned up, literally in a pen, far off from the facility. And they had searches. They wanted people coming and going to make sure that there were no infiltrators coming in and making trouble. They had police, I call them Cossacks, Cossacks on horseback roaming through the woods just to make sure that nothing untoward was going on. No bushwhackers were lying in wait or anything like that.
Well, so they pulled out all the stops.
They really did. And I, as I said at the event, I kind of liked the police state aesthetic. It went over well with me. And I actually gave a little talk at the end of the conference, not on the official program, but the reports from the field section of the program. I gave a talk. Patrick Casey of Identity Europa gave a talk. Martin O'Toole gave a brief talk. And I am forgetting one other person who gave a talk, I'm afraid. But it all went really well. So that was my first time at the podium, on the podium at the lectern at AMREN. So it was a really good month of travel. Yeah, it was a very good time, all told. So, yeah, in terms of people, there are about 175, I believe, in Stockholm, more than 200 in Helsinki, more than 200 in AMREN. Of course, AMREN was in a country of about 300 million, whereas the Helsinki event, which had just a few fewer people, was in a country of 5 million. Mm-hmm. And that is no criticism of AMREN. That's really a criticism of America. America's cultural immune system is very, very weak compared to that of Scandinavian countries or European countries in general. And even though we like to laugh at how crazy Sweden is, the Swedes have a much more robust ethno-nationalist movement, despite all the craziness of their government, than we do in the United States. And so we need to be taking notes and learning from them, which is why I go on these trips. I don't call them speaking tours. I call them listening tours, because I'm listening and taking notes and trying to understand what they're doing right and how we can replicate it in the United States.
Well, I would also have to say, I mean, Sweden always gets the rap for being, you know, supposedly the craziest liberal country. And yeah, you know, there is some justification for that, but I really think at this point we'd have to look at England. I mean, when you have a country where people like Martin Selner and Lawrence Southern are being declared terrorists, to me that's about as cuffed as you can get. When, I mean, you're actually being banned from the country.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't, knock on wood, been banned yet, or at least not that I know of. Of course, I'm not going to be going back to the UK. I'm not going to try to go back to the UK until they have some regime change there, I'm afraid. I do not want to be in a situation like many friends of mine have been in, where one friend of ours was about to get on a plane just to change planes at Heathrow and was informed by the airline that he could not enter the airspace of the UK and that he had to get a new flight.
That's incredible. I mean, that's just insane.
As soon as I heard about that, I immediately changed my travel plans, because when I was leaving Europe, I was supposed to change planes at Gatwick, and I did not want to take the risk of getting to the airport in Budapest and not being able to board because of the British Home Office. I do wonder about what's going on in Great Britain. The crackdown on nationalist dissent and anti-Muslim dissent is really hardcore now, and it seems kind of hysterical. And I do have this theory that our enemies do pay attention to facts, not in charting their broad policy courses, because of course if they paid any attention to reality, then they wouldn't be doing this crazy stuff. But I do think they poll the people a lot. They monitor what's going on, and they do make sort of short-term decisions about that. And my feeling is that these kinds of crackdowns are indicative that they're aware that something very, very serious might be coming down the pike. And my feeling is that maybe there's an intifada brewing in the UK amongst the Muslim population there. And because of this, of course, they're not going to crack down in any open way on Muslims, because that would be traducing the laws of political correctness. But they will crack down on us because they're afraid that we'll agitate the Muslims. And I'm thinking that maybe that is what's going on there. In which case, things could get very, very surprisingly intense and scary in the UK in the coming months.
I think that's possible, but I also just think, I mean, they've got Brexit happening, they've seen Trump, they've seen the populist wave across Europe, and I think they're just realizing that, oh, you know, this stuff that we used to think was really marginal doesn't seem that way anymore, and, you know, and the powers that be are ordering them to, you know, kind of shore up the defenses using the old tactics again. Because, you know, I think when we started doing this, I think they were concerned about us, but I think they kind of dismissed us as kind of cranky and marginal. But I think they've started to realize that, you know, oh, actually, you know, maybe these people are actually, you know, sort of like the forefront of something. So, yeah, I think it definitely is indicative of a change, whether maybe it's both what you and I have discussed.
Well, I think that those things are actually related, because the greater presence of Islam on the continent, and especially since the migrant crisis began in 2014, has been a spur towards the nationalist reaction. And I think that these things go hand in hand. And I do think that the establishment in the UK is definitely trying to keep control over this. So I think it's very, very important that we understand what's going on there. They're trying to keep control of this. And I think that they really can't. And I'm wondering how many people in the European political establishment at this point have given up on the idea that they can really ram through multiculturalism. And I'm wondering how many of these people are switching over to the idea that maybe they can manage their decline and come out on top in some new order that's brewing. There was a certain decision that was made, not all at the same time, in a kind of wave, in 1989, 1990, when communism started falling. A lot of people started thinking, this horse is not a horse we can back, and they started trying to figure out how they could position themselves in the next regime. And I'm wondering if people in the current establishment aren't already making those kinds of calculations and thinking in terms of managing the decline so that they you know, end up on top with whatever comes next.
I don't know about in the UK, but I've got to believe that that's happening in other countries, because there actually are these parties on the rise and, you know, coming to power.
Right.
So they know they're going to have to work with them, right. Whether they want to or not.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about what's happening in Central Europe, where you are. Everyone's pretty much up to date, I think, on events in Poland and the V4 countries, although there's some new things happening in Hungary. But there's been some very positive news in the last couple of months in Italy, also in Austria, and now in Slovenia. So what are you seeing from your vantage point in Central Europe, John?
Well, in Hungary, of course, the big story was that 2 months ago, Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party won in a landslide. You know, they didn't lose a single parliamentary seat, even though they were expected to, because the opposition was a lot more energized this time around. That didn't help them one bit. You know, I wrote about this extensively at Countercurrents already, so I won't go into any detail about it. But, you know, basically Orban, the entire campaign was based around the issue of immigration and multiculturalism and Soros and his organizations. They're really, there was almost no other discussion of any other issues in the campaign. So it that shows that that truly was the winning issue in Hungary, and it shows that Hungarians are conscious of these issues. So that was a very hopeful sign. And the other big news since the election is that the government has announced this new tax that if you're an organization that supports the rights of quote unquote refugees, or, you know, let's call them migrants, to enter Hungary, to enter the EU, then you have to pay a special tax for border security, which I think is a brilliant move. And about a week after the government announced this, or rather, the government announced it before the election, but about a week after the election, the Open Society Foundations, which is Soros's main organ, announced that they were going to leave Budapest. And then, you know, this news sort of exploded across the internet. And then the very next day, they were like, well, we haven't made a decision on that just yet. But then a couple of weeks later, they announced and said, well, yes, actually, we're moving to Berlin now. So that's official. I mean, I think it's largely a symbolic victory. You know that they're not going to just give up on Hungary. They're just going to have to be more subtle about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But still, it is a victory, and it is significant. So, you know, we should feel good about that. The other thing I feel I should mention is that Jobbik, which is the main opposition party in Hungary. Again, I wrote about this extensively in my articles, but they used to be more radical than Fidesz, but they've kind of reinvented themselves over the last couple of years as being more of a liberal conservative party. And where they stand on just about any issue is unclear anymore. But both before and since the election, in the first weeks after the elections, all of the leftist organizations and parties were having these demonstrations in the streets of Budapest, because Hungary itself tends to be a very right-wing country, but what liberals there are mostly in Budapest in Hungary. So they did have these fairly sizable demonstrations, and Jobbik was marching right alongside of them and protesting alongside them. So, you know, they've always insisted that they agree with the government on the issue of immigration and border security, even though they didn't initially. This has kind of been glossed over, but like when the border fence with Serbia was first proposed, Jobbik condemned it as being a return to Cold War borders. They'd rather forget about that now, but but all of this just kind of goes to show that they're willing to basically forsake any principles in the name of, you know, the pursuit of power. And this was really driven home just recently because sort of the last remaining major figure who could be considered genuinely right-wing in Jobbik was Laszlo Toroczkai, who's the mayor of Asotalom. That's the town on the border with Serbia where the border fence was built. And Toroczkai was the one who first proposed this idea that ended up being adopted by the government. And over the last couple of years, Jobbik had basically kicked out, or people had voluntarily left who were considered too extreme on the right. Toroczkai was one of the last of, even though he only joined the leadership of Jobbik 2 years ago, he was considered one of the last of sort of the old guard of Jobbik, you know, that represented genuine right-wing principles. And a couple of weeks ago, he proposed a platform. I should backtrack a little bit. When the election ended, Gábor Vanó, who'd been leading Jobbik for more than a decade, resigned. And there was an election held to see who the new leader should be. And Toroczkai was very hopeful that he would be the one who would win. He did not. It was very close. I think he got something like 46% of the votes, something like that. I know it was in the 40s. But another candidate who, interestingly enough, was a skinhead in his youth, but has also kind of reinvented himself and now, you know, belongs to this liberal arm of Jobbik. He actually won the election. So it was pretty obvious to everyone that Jobbik was just going to be continuing in this line of, you know, basically becoming the center for opposition to Orban, but otherwise not representing anything, you know, genuinely rightist anymore. And you know, showing that they were willing to work with groups in favor of migration, like the Soros organizations. So Tordichkai, in response, said, well, I received almost 50% of the votes. That obviously means I represent almost 50% of the party. And here is a proposal for a series of principles that I demand Jobbik adopt as part of its program. And it was sort of an attempt to bring Jobbik back around, you know, at least somewhat to its rightist roots. And my Hungarian friends who are familiar with the party told me that there was no way that the Jobbik leadership would ever agree to this. So they think that Tordichkai probably did it deliberately to engineer his own eviction from the party so that he could do it, you know, while saving face without, he, instead of saying he resigned, he could say, oh, they kicked me out because I was too much of a rightist. And it worked. They were quite angered by this proposal. And just a few days ago, they did, in fact, announce that he was being kicked out of the party. And Duro Dura, who's another more of the more conservative candidates in the party, leaders of the party, also resigned. So it really looks like now the last vestiges of the right wing of Jobbik are gone. Some people are saying that Tordichkai may start up his own party. I hope that's true, because I think, as we've discussed before, Greg, on these podcasts, I mean, the ideal relationship in Hungarian politics before was that, you know, Fidesz traditionally was a center-right party, and Jobbik was on the more extreme right. And because Jobbik was so popular, they've always polled around, you know, 20% popularity or even more. They always forced Fidesz to kind of go further to the right to try to head off Jobbik from gaining more popularity. And this was good because it always pulled Fidesz further to the right. When they reinvented themselves in this way, it left Fidesz as the most radical right-wing party in Hungary, you know, at least of the major ones. And while I certainly have a lot of positive things to say about Fidesz, I don't want to sound like I'm saying that they need to be replaced, because I think they're doing a very good job right now. But I think part of the reason why they got to where they were was that they had this force pulling them further to the right. So if Tordichkai could form a new party, and if it could start pulling the same kinds of numbers in the polls that Jobbik used to, that would be fantastic. That would go back to the way things were, and I think that would be great for the country. So we'll just have to see how things pan out in the coming months.
Yeah, the way I was putting it when we had a lunch in Budapest with a friend of ours who's a political insider there, we don't need to mention his name. But anyway, we were talking about this very issue, and I said what happened with Jobbik was they defined success in the wrong way. They defined success as actually gaining political power. And of course, that would be natural for a political party to do. Yet, if they had recognized that their positive role and their primary success was to be the people who set the tone and set the pace for Fidesz and sort of made sure that Fidesz, that they fed good ideas to Fidesz, and they kept Fidesz on the straight and narrow, so to speak, because they were a little further to the right and they had a substantial support base. And so Jobbik didn't recognize or didn't appreciate how much soft power they really had in terms of their ability to influence the political mainstream and the agenda of the ruling party. And because they were more interested in actual hard political power than soft ideological political power, right, they reinvented their ideology in a really shocking move, because you thought these people were principled, but you realize no, they're moving to the center because they want to get elected. They tossed overboard all kinds of principles that you'd think would be sacred to them.
And people.
Yeah. And they failed. And so if Toro Shikai creates a new party, I think he will understand, I hope he understands, that the success of that party primarily has to be measured in terms of its soft power and its ability to influence the ruling coalition. And really, that's the most important thing. Its ability to influence Fidesz and whatever role it can play in sort of a coalition government. Because right now, Orban is a dominant figure. I mean, he's just the best politician in Hungary, aside from the ideological issues, just in terms of his ability to build coalitions and command respect and get things done. He's simply the best politician they've got. And, you know, they're going to have to think down the road, a couple of decades down the road, maybe, when Orban is old, or Orban might die, or Orban might retire, then maybe a party further to the right could take on a more powerful role in the country in terms of actual political power. But until then, they can enjoy a huge amount of success if they define success properly as soft power and influence over the political mainstream, moving it to the right.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, some people were even speculating before Jobbik transformed themselves that Orban was even, you know, in a way sort of grooming Jobbik to be able to take over whenever he retires. I mean, maybe that won't be for 10 or 20 years, but that all changed when they adopted this new strategy because, I mean, of course, there was always the usual tit for tat between the parties before, but the last couple of years, you know, Jobbik came out aggressively against Orban and Fidesz, you know, over issues like corruption, even threatening Orban personally in some matters. And, you know, from what I've heard from some of my friends who are with insider's knowledge, you know, they really consider this a betrayal by Jobbik. And so that just, you know, immediately went out the window, you know, this idea that they could become their successors. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm just an observer, but it really seems to me that it was a strategy that didn't really make sense, except if you wanted a quick and dirty victory. You know, I talked to one journalist, Hungarian journalist here once, who told me that, you know, basically Jobbik's strategy was to try to link up the radical right with all the Budapest liberals who, you know, hate Orban more than anything else. You know, they'll basically support anybody to get rid of Orban. But he commented that the problem with that is that maybe there's 10%, you know, Western-style liberals in the whole country. So he said, you know, it didn't really make sense as a winning strategy to try, you know, because basically they had to alienate half of their right-wing supporters to get that 10%. And once they accomplished that, basically they ended up right back where they started. I mean, they did essentially the same as they did in this election as they did 4 years ago. So, yeah, it was a strategy that didn't work. So it's just yet another example of how, you know, moderation is not the path to success for right-wing parties. Everyone thinks that it is, but
mainstreaming is not the path to political success. Mainstreaming by dropping your principles might help individual politicians who are ambitious gain some kind of success, but it's the principles that matter. And getting the principles accepted, and so dropping those principles to gain political power is just a dumb move. And yeah, the fall of Jobbik is a great illustration of why mainstreaming is a bad thing and doesn't work, and why being a principled political opposition actually does work, because when they were further to the right of Fidesz, they were actually accomplishing a great deal for their principles, for their agenda. And as soon as they dropped that, well, they didn't actually accomplish anything after that point.
No, it's very questionable to see how they accomplished anything of value in this election other than to, attempt to undermine Fidesz. Fortunately, it didn't work. But in fact, if anything, it probably helped to energize the Fidesz base, because all of the Hungarian pundits and even some of Fidesz's own representatives were predicting that You have to get two-thirds of the parliament to have a supermajority, which means if you have a simple majority over 50%, you know, you can govern. But in order to make changes to the constitution without going to one of the other parties and cooperating, you have to have at least two-thirds. And all of the pundits were saying, oh, you know, Fidesz isn't going to make it this time. Everyone thought they would win. But it was thought that they would miss that mark. And even some of the Fidesz's own people thought that. But they made it anyway. And one of the interpretations of that is that Fidesz's hardcore supporters were so frightened by what they saw as, you know, Jobbik's potential success that they came out in greater numbers, you know, just to make sure that that didn't happen. So it had a very good effect, but not the effect that Jobbik planned on the election.
Right, exactly. I'm sure a few people voted out of disgust at this betrayal that they were witnessing too.
Oh, I know more than one person who used to be Jobbik supporter who voted Fidesz this time just because they were horrified.
Right, because Fidesz was upholding the principles that they valued in politics, and they saw their home party, Jobbik, abandoning their principles. So let this be a lesson to the mainstreamers out there. The whole point of our politics is to bring the mainstream to us eventually, not drop our principles in order to get mainstream approval, because the normies are full of it right now. The normies don't want what we want. And until we change what they want, until we change their values and their outlook, they're not going to come in our direction. And if we go in their direction, well, we can go in their direction only in the sense that we adopt clever marketing strategies to get our principles across. But if we drop the principles in the process, we're simply losing sight of what our real goals are. And that's, you know, that's just folly. That's criminal folly. And I'm afraid that Jobbik engaged in a bit of this criminal folly, and they were duly punished for it by the voters of Hungary, by the better voters of Hungary, by the more perceptive voters of Hungary. So it's a good lesson for us all. Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in some of the neighboring countries to Hungary. And I don't mean Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovakia, where things are going well, but I'm talking about Austria and Slovenia. And next door to Austria and Slovenia is Italy. There has been a lot of really positive change in that part of Europe. And now we've got sensible countries stretching from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic at this point. I'm very, very encouraged by that. So the biggest thing is the final formation of an Italian government after their elections. And this is a great populist alliance. It's an alliance between populists of the right and the left. They put aside some of their differences on certain issues to deal with the great threat, which is globalization, especially as being pushed by the European Union. The establishment, the pro-EU globalist establishment in Italy, vetoed basically one of their finance minister proposals, and so they got a different finance minister. I was wondering if they would actually just try a new election, but they decided just to put a new finance minister in. And then as soon as the government was formed, they moved forward and said, okay, pack your bags, we're getting rid of 500,000 migrants. And I was talking about this with a friend, and I said, you know, Italy is a serious country in the sense that it's a big country. You know, Poland is 38 million people. Hungary is fewer than 10 million people. People can ignore countries of 10 million. They can ignore countries of 2 million, like Slovenia. And then I pulled up Wikipedia and I looked at the population numbers in Italy, and Italy's population was 60,500,000. I said, well, you can scratch the 500,000. They're packing their bags, but there's 60 million Italians. That is not a country that is easy to push around.
Well, they're also, aren't they the third largest economy in Europe?
Yeah, I think so.
So that's also pretty important.
Yeah, seriously. And they're talking about measures not just to basically get rid of the migrants who are coming in, who have behaved in a beastly way, but also They're talking about getting out of the euro. They're talking about instituting things that will totally blast eurozone austerity measures, like a guaranteed minimum national income, which is all the more reason to get rid of migrants, too. You don't want to share that with carpetbaggers and newcomers coming in. But that's extraordinary, and I don't know if that'll go forward, but just the very idea of it is probably causing a lot of sweat in Brussels right now. So the Italians are moving in a populist direction. They've formed a populist government. I think this is tremendously important. My feeling was, I was betting it would always be France that would be the first major country in Europe. And by major countries, I mean basically four countries: the UK, Germany, France, and Italy. I thought that France would be the first to form this kind of populist government, but they've done it in Italy. I was wrong. And Italy, though, has always had a very, very robust rightist culture. And they didn't undergo, you know, the equivalent of denazification after World War II. They've always had parties of the right with a continuity to fascism, you know, it represented in elections. They don't have the hostility towards right-wing populist ideas and parties that baked into their system like Germany did after the Second World War. And, you know, they have a healthier rightist subculture even than France. So it shouldn't have surprised me, but I was thinking the French would do it first for whatever reason. But this is great. So I'm very, very encouraged by that. The new chancellor in Austria, Kurz, is closing down mosques and sending imams away, specifically ones that preach radicalism, which is a good thing. Erdogan in Turkey is saying that this is going to lead to some great confrontation. And I just look at that and I think, bring it on. The more agitation that the Turks engage in Europe, the more they make clear that they regard Turkish immigrant communities as a fifth column in Europe, the better. The sooner these countries will wake up and the sooner they will speed these people on their way back to their homeland. So I think that this kind of tit for tat is great. You know, a lot of people who are on our side, you know, sort of radicals who just say they've got to all go back, they look at things like mosque closures or headscarf bans and stuff like that, and they think, oh, this is too little. It's too little. But they don't understand basic strategies, time-tested strategies of political agitation. When you're trying to agitate your populace and your opponents so that your people can get behind your proposals, you start out with things that are small and doable and reasonable. And what is more reasonable than closing down mosques funded by foreign powers where you have imams preaching bloodshed? Basically, these people are preaching radical stuff that has no place in any European society. It's a reasonable measure. And then what you do by putting these reasonable measures through and acting on them is you sit back and you watch your enemies go nuts. And that's what Erdogan is doing. He's overreacting. He's tipping his hand. And now the normies in Austria are seeing that they have a bigger problem than just a few mosques with a few radical imams. And so what this is doing is it is educating the people to get them behind more radical measures. And I think that we have to recognize that, yes, just talking about Islam is not enough. However, talking about Islam is a way of agitating the Muslim community so that they can educate and radicalize our people so we can build a greater and greater consensus behind removing these people entirely, not just the radicals, the entire population. So I look at what's happening in Austria quite favorably. Have you been following any of that? I know you were in Iceland at the time this was going on.
Not so much Austria. Italy, I have been. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought what happened in Italy was great because that was, It's sort of like if the Bernie Sanders supporters, the Trump supporters had formed an alliance and worked.
Yeah.
You know, it just goes to show, I mean, how much more mature European politics can be. But yeah, Salvini is Minister of the Interior now. I think that's great. It's a little bit too bad that they couldn't get this finance minister in who they wanted, you know, to put in, who wanted to take them out of the Eurozone. But, I guess he's still there. Just, I forget what position they gave him, but they gave him a slightly, less powerful position, but he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's great. Do you want me to talk about Slovenia a little bit?
Yeah. Have you been following that? I don't know that much about Slovenian politics, honestly. I've never even been there. But are we going to make Slovenia Leibach again? Is this is this what's happening?
Yes. Well, you know, I think because Melania, that's how they say it in Slovenia, is kind of a heroine there. Janez Janša, who got the most votes in the election recently, actually adopted Trump's slogans. You know, he was using Make Slovenia Great Again and also Slovenia First were his slogans. And about a month before the election, Viktor Orban actually paid a visit, very public visit to Slovenia and endorsed Janša. And it got to the point where my friends in Slovenia were telling me that the leftists were accusing Janša of actually being like an Orban puppet, which is kind of amusing in a way. I don't know as much about Slovenia as I do about Hungary. I know a little bit. From what I know about Janša and his SDS party, he's not somebody, you know, we should be praising like Orban or Salvini. He has kind of a problematic past. He's the only potential leader of a European country at the moment who's actually served actual jail time for corruption. I mean, of course, he actually claims he was framed, but even my right-wing Slovenian friends say that they think that's unlikely, that he's always been kind of a shady character. But, you know, he wants to take a firm stand on the migrant crisis. And this is very important because right now, you know, Hungary is standing strong against migration. Now we have Austria going in the right way. Now Italy's going in the right way. Slovenia might seem like a very tiny, insignificant country, but it isn't if you look at the map because, as people know, the EU also has this thing called the Schengen zone. And once migrants penetrate any Schengen country, they are then free to basically go wherever they want within the Schengen zone. And not all the EU countries are in Schengen, but most of them are, and all of the big ones are, including Sweden and Germany and France. So that's very important. And if you look at the Schengen zone, that border, the only part that's unsecured at the moment is Slovenia. So the SDS party is actually promising to close their border with Croatia. Croatia is not in the Schengen zone, even though they're in the EU. So it's vital that border be closed. That'll basically cut off the last entry point along the Balkan route for the migrants. So it's very important that we get a party in there that will actually protect the border, and Janša has promised to do that. The problem is that he did very well in the election 2 weeks ago. He got just under 25% of the vote, which was more than double what any of the other parties got. The problem is that obviously 25%, that's not enough to actually govern with on your own. And all of the other parties that got significant results were left-wing parties. And all of them have promised that they would not form a coalition with the SDS. So right now things are sort of in a gridlock like they were in Italy, and it's not clear what's going to happen. But I was just speaking with one of my Slovene friends yesterday, and it seems like there's a possibility there's going to have to be another election. So we'll just have to see what develops there. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like Janša can pull off, you know, like Salvini, a coalition deal. It looks like you know, they're going to have to just keep going to the polls till they get something clear results, unfortunately. But hopefully the fact that he's so popular right now and the left-wing parties are stonewalling him, hopefully that will generate anger in the public and, you know, make them more inclined to vote for him in another election. That'll put them over the top.
If he manages that well, I it could very well work to his advantage. So let's keep an eye on Slovenia and keep our fingers crossed for Slovenia. Because, yeah, it is in a very important position in terms of the Balkan route into the Schengen zone. So, yes, it's a small country, but through tiny little chinks in dikes, you can have great floods coming through. And if that little hole can be stopped up, that would be a great thing for Europe, at least for the short run, which is, you know, we want every victory we can get, long run and short run.
Well, I mean, with the migrant crisis as intense as it is, the short run is very crucial. And the problem is, I mean, Slovenia in Hungary, Hungarians are so conservative minded and so, you know, they really don't like outsiders, especially non-European outsiders. Even none of the leftist parties in Hungary, none of the major ones, came out in favor of migration during the election. It's not that way in Slovenia, though. Slovenia tracks much further towards the center, and they're very pro-EU, unlike Hungary, which tends to be very Eurosceptic. So, you know, if the left wing manages to stay in power there, that's going to be a problem because, you know, they've condemned Janša and the SDS for xenophobia, for, you know, being hostile to refugees, all this kind of stuff. So chances are that if they manage to retain power, they're not going to do anything if the migrants start flowing through there. Mm-hmm. So all the efforts of the other countries, at least as far as all of Europe is concerned, could be undermined if they don't do their job. So it's much more important than it might seem on the surface.
Well, great. Let's transition to a little bit of shop talk about what's going on around the office at Countercurrents. We had a DDoS attack recently, and a number of our people were caught up in our countermeasures, and their IP addresses were blocked. And you might be hearing this on YouTube because you can't even get to Countercurrents. And if you need to get unblocked, write to webmaster@counter-currents.com and find your IP address. Just type into your Google or whatever search engine, "What is my IP address?" and it will pop up. Find your IP address, copy it, paste it into an email, and send it to webmaster@counter-currents.com, and we'll get you unblocked. We've managed to unblock most people, I think, who have been caught up in that. But if there are a few out there who are hearing this for the first time and been wondering why they can't come to Countercurrents, it's nothing personal. It was just part of the countermeasures that we had to take because we were getting swarmed basically by bots coming out of, I believe, Brazil, actually. They were coming out of Brazil, the bots from Brazil. And they were basically just querying our website for information so many times that people couldn't get to it. And so people weren't able to access Countercurrents. And they wanted to shut us down that way. And it went on for a number of days. They also hit a number of other sites on the right. And we worked together with people to counterman that, and it was fairly successful. Eventually, they gave up. But again, if you are blocked from Countercurrents, type in, "What is my IP address?" Copy the number that pops up and email it to webmaster@counter-currents.com. And if you're a legit person, if you're not one of the bots, right, we will unblock your IP address.
So, or if you're not certain, then take a VoIP-Conf test and then send us the result.
Exactly. So, John, the big project that you've been trying to wrap up is Francis Parker Yockey's The World in Flames. So what is the latest on that? Everyone's waiting eagerly for that book. It's one of our best-selling titles.
Yes, I want to apologize. I know it's been delayed, but in my defense, I want to say that it's not just because the work was taking longer, although this one did has taken quite a lot of effort, you know, tracking down and especially reading these old documents and old FBI files and things. But we keep finding new material. And I've been very grateful because I've, you know, put out several calls on the website and, we've had people respond. Like there was an essay that Yaki published in the very first issue of the Union newspaper, which was the newspaper of Sir Oswald Mosley's Union movement in 1947, I believe, or maybe it was 48. And there was a paragraph missing because the copy that Kerry Bolton and I had been chewed on by rats, and one paragraph was illegible as a result. But fortunately, a Countercurrents reader came through and was able to get that missing paragraph for us. Well, the other item that's been problematic was there was an essay that Yaki wrote about a year before his death in 1959 on China. We don't even know the actual title of it. Some people have referred to it as Yaki's China Estimate, but we don't know if that was the actual title or just what people started calling it. But we know that it was circulated in some kind of rough form, mimeographed or something like that, probably in the 1970s. So we know that there must be copies out there, but we don't know anyone who has a complete one. What we have, the last couple of pages of it, and we will include that in the volume regardless. But of course, we'd like to include the whole thing. So if anybody knows of a complete copy of this, if you have one or you know somebody who has one, please get in touch with me. You know, my email address is on the Countercurrents site. You know, I'd really love to be able to include that. But otherwise, we'll just include what we have. But apart from that, we've also been finding other material. Kerry Bolton came across just a few days ago an essay attributed to Frederick Weiss called Brotherhood that was published in four parts in the National Renaissance Bulletin, which was the newsletter of the National Renaissance Party in New York in 1953. And he's convinced that it was actually written by Yaki because a number of the things attributed to Weiss were actually written by Yaki. And he goes into all of this in his introduction to the piece. So we're adding that to the book. And there also were some bits and pieces from letters that were found in some FBI files that we discovered online relating to Yaki that we hadn't known about before. We just discovered these a couple of weeks ago. There's also summaries from and excerpts from issues of Front Fighter, which was the newsletter of Yaki's own group. That was the European Liberation Front that we discovered in these FBI files. So we're also adding those. So I'm not going to say that when we're done that this is going to be a comprehensive collection of Yaki's shorter pieces, because I'm quite convinced, given that we're still finding things now, that we're almost undoubtedly going to find things in the years to come. So we'll have to do a revised edition. But we realize we can't keep all of you waiting out there forever, since this thing is already overdue. So we're going to take what we have now and wrap it up. So I'm hoping within the next couple of days to finish everything up that remains on it, and then we just have to finish the layout and the index, and then it's basically ready to go. So that's where things stand as of now. But all the layouts and the editing on the bulk of the book is already complete. We're just adding these last items at present.
Right. You know, it was very interesting. Kerry Bolton tried to get a hold of FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act. And so he got a bunch of files from the FBI and went through them. And then I bought Willis Carto's papers connected with Yaki from his widow, Elizabeth Carto. And that included some photos and correspondence with Yaki's family and so forth, and also some FBI files. And it turned out that those FBI files were different from the FBI files that were given to Kerry Bolton. And so we had to send those off to Kerry to look at, and that those files included excerpts from correspondence with a woman that Yaki knew that we had not seen before. And then only a couple weeks ago, somebody pointed out that on archive.org, there were large numbers of FBI files connected with Francis Parker Yaki that somebody had gotten from an FOI, FOIA request. And those included many, many pages. How many pages were in those files?
Almost 2,000.
Almost 2,000 pages.
In fact, I still have some to go through just to make sure that there's nothing in them that should be included. Although I think I found everything, me and Kerry. But yeah, that's huge.
And what percentage? Huge. Yeah, what percentage of those 2,000 pages were things that we had not seen before from the other FBI file requests?
Well, I have not examined the other FBI files as thoroughly as Kerry Bolton has, but he told me that he hadn't seen any of it before.
Oh my God. Well, this is a lesson to every researcher out there. If you need information from the FBI, you've got to do these requests multiple times, because every time you make a request, there might be new information. In fact, maybe we should, for when we start looking into doing a second edition of this, we should make another FOIA request to the FBI. There might be more material there. According to a letter from Keith Stimley to Willis Cardo, when Stimley got these, Cardo had requested files, and then Stimley requested files. And what happened was they both got different sets of files, too. So we know of at least four sets of divergent FBI files connected with Francis Parker Yaki. And also, Stimley received a letter from the FBI explaining, he asked about a number of pieces by Yaki that were listed as being present in his suitcase or his briefcase when he was arrested. There are a number of essays, including erotica, that apparently Yaki had written. And Stimley wrote to the FBI and said, "Do you have these?" And he received this letter saying, "No, in accordance with the paperwork or Paper Storage Reduction Act of 1970, we threw all these things away," which is really shocking. And you just wonder, well, maybe they weren't thrown away. Maybe all this stuff will come to light eventually. Maybe J. Edgar Hoover had it in his private safe for his own personal delectation or something. Maybe some of this stuff will come to light. So it is very, very interesting, though, that Francis Parker Yaki apparently wrote erotica. And who knows, maybe he was publishing it under pen names in various journals of that kind of writing. I guess journals is a more exalted term than is proper, but various magazines from the 50s. So maybe we can get some pornography collectors, some people who collect 50s era stag mags or whatever they're called, to start reading through their collections and see if there are any references to Faustianism or something like that worked in. Eventually, maybe volume 4 of Yaki's writings will be his collected erotica.
Or culture distorters, that would be one.
Yeah, we could call it the culture distorters.
Well, I meant that would be a word to watch for, to see if...
Oh, yes, yeah, exactly. He would somehow work culture distortion into it somehow, I would imagine. Yeah, so he was an interesting international man of mystery, a real character.
Well, actually, you know, in the 50s and 60s, that was, if you were an aspiring writer and you were having trouble making ends meet, porn was, erotica was considered a way of doing that. It's like, I know a lot of the Beats did it. And Yaki, you know, when you read his letters and so forth, he was always hard up for cash. So it's possible he did something like that just for money.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. So I am sure that not only will we be publishing another edition of this volume in coming years as more things come to light, but also that there will be some very interesting discoveries connected with Francis Parker Yaki. It's very interesting. Since he died in 1960 and most of his political activity was for the late 40s and the 50s, that's just a little too far back for us to find material easily. if he would had been more active in the 1960s, for instance, I think we would have had a lot more material a lot more quickly come to light. Because, for instance, it's been very, very easy for me to put together complete collections of George Lincoln Rockwell's periodicals and so forth, whereas it's almost impossible to find copies of Front Fighter, which was Yaki's periodical. So, I mean, I wish somebody had started this project a long time ago, but they did. I mean, Steinle started this project maybe in the late 70s, and even then he couldn't gather a lot of this stuff together. And one of the things you note from Yaki's surviving correspondence is he's always telling people to destroy his letters. And unfortunately, a lot of people did.
That's the thing, though, is that, I mean, Rockwell was a very public figure, whereas Yaki was so secretive almost to a fault, I would say, because it almost restricted him from getting anything done, because he was always so worried about maintaining secrecy about everything. So I think that contributes to it as well. He probably didn't distribute this stuff to a lot of people.
Right. And his friends Weiss and Thompson, who are his most close intellectual and political collaborators. Well, I've gone through the H. Keith Thompson papers at the Hoover Institution, and I found some interesting stuff, but I didn't find any unpublished works by Yaki. But maybe I need to go back there and go through those boxes one more time, looking for something that doesn't have any names on it, but called the China Estimate, for instance. It could very well be in his papers, because if it was being circulated in mimeograph form, it was probably circulated by Weiss or Thompson or both. And it could be in the Thompson papers. So it's worth going through the Thompson papers one more time. I'm just going to have to book a time when I can spend a couple of days in Palo Alto at the Hoover Institution going through those files.
Yeah. Well, perhaps in the revised edition we'll have the complete China essay. I've kind of given up hope for this one, for this mm-hmm. edition. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. Maybe we'll get lucky in the next few days here.
Great. Well, we have a number of other projects coming up, but we've been going for more than an hour. So I think we should wrap up at this time, and we'll just continue the conversation on the next episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, everybody.